Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest for this episode is quite simply one of the finest absurdist comedians working today. He's been described as a sort of absurdist Simon Amstel by The Guardian, joyously silly by The Evening Standard, a comedy legend by To-Do List, and an absolute idiot by Fest. His 2019 Edinburgh Fringe show, Jos Norris's Dead Long Live Mr. Fruit Salad, was one of the word-of-mouth hits at the Edinburgh Fringe that year, winning the Comedian's Choice Award for Best Show. That's one of the most prestigious awards to win at the Fringe, as only those who have taken a comedy show to that year's festival are eligible to vote for it, so it's truly and literally for the comedian's comedian. The show was also nominated for the Malcolm Hardy Award for Comic Originality, the Chortle Award for Best Music and Variety Act, was longlisted for the much-coveted Edinburgh Comedy Award, and as well as selling out its Fringe run, later transferred to an extended run at London's Soho Theatre. In 2020, he adapted what would have been a new live show into an online-streamed feature film, which managed to unite both The Guardian and The Telegraph in praise and celebration. And this year, his comedy special for BBC Radio 4, A Small Talk on Small Talk, was one of the first original comedy programmes broadcast in 2021 and was a Guardian audio pick of the week. And we've not even got time to go into the rest of his back catalogue, like how his short films and web series have been selected for and won awards at film festivals around the world. Over the hour, we discuss, amongst so much else, absurdism, desert island-based reunions, and the comedic inspiration and sexual awakening which came from a regional performance of The Master and Margarita. And listeners will be pleased to know that this isn't just a Spieling the Beans episode. Oh, no, 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 no. For the first 10 minutes, it's also, apparently, the pilot for a brand new Pierce Brosnan fanzine podcast. So, you know, it's just excellent value for money. And so with that, please welcome my guest for this week, Jos Norris. Jos Norris, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Lovely to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. You are, in fact, the first guest we've had who was recovering from COVID when we booked them.
Yeah. I got out on, I think, Friday. So I think I'm now just under a week into freedom, which I haven't done much with. But when you've not done anything in 10 days, it's very lovely to do even the few things you can do.
Totally.
Have you had it?
No, I've been in full lockdown for basically since the middle of March, because I live with my 90-year-old grandmother.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess. Got to be careful. God.
Yes, although she's probably got a better metabolism than I. But
so it's more about you protecting yourself than anything else.
She's shielding me, effectively, yes.
Right. Do you miss stuff, or are you actually kind of enjoying it? Because I've got to the point where it's kind of a nice excuse, in a way, which is a bad mindset, but that's sort of where I'm at now.
I think the summers that I spent inside anyway, as a teenager, turned out very good training.
Yeah, good prep.
Yeah. So it's been good. It's been very good having a podcast that can exist online and that the technology is there. 20 years ago, would have been a lot worse. But now...
Oh, it would have been terrible. Would have got through all my DVDs very quickly and then had to do them again. VHSs, actually, when I was a teenager.
Yes, and therefore no special features, no deleted
scenes. No. Sometimes you'd get very lucky and maybe they'd put like a little short at the end of the tape, but rare, very rare that.
Yeah, you have
wasn't
to
really worth the effort, I think.
Totally. You have to just exist on the coming soon to a video store near you.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. And then go, wow, this is great.
Exactly. Well, you seem like you're in good health and spirits.
Yeah, I think I'm better. I think I've had one dose of the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So I think that stopped it from getting as bad as it could.
Sure.
And it was nasty for about 3 days, but it never got to my breathing. I never struggled to breathe. I just felt like tired and like achy bones and had to stay in bed and sore throat and stuff for about 3 days. So it's not nice. People should be careful about it. But hopefully we are at the point where, you know, the vaccines stop it from being as bad as it could be. So I'm all right. I'm recovered.
Fantastic. And a fantastic PSA. If you're listening to this and you haven't got a vaccine yet.
Yeah, go get it. Probably worth doing.
That's the official NHS slogan.
Yeah. Just, overall, worth it.
Worth a shot.
Yeah, yeah, that's quite good, actually.
There we go.
That's very clever. I like that.
Well, patent pending. well, yes, thank you for coming on the show. I am
no pleasure.
I'm a huge fan of yours. I'll say it up front, you're one of the, I think, one of the best, most creative comedic voices out
there. Ah, wow, thank you. It's very kind.
Well, it is sincere. It is, for those not familiar with your comedy, I put it alongside Bo Burnham, James Acaster.
People totally. Bloody love Bo Burnham at the moment. That's exciting company to be put in.
Well, it's well deserved.
Thank you.
And now this proves an awkward pivot because my follow up is that I when doing the research I do for the show about you, I realised that a lot of the it seems like a lot of your psyche, a lot of how you approach the world, a lot of how you try and explain thoughts and ideas seems very similar to my own thinking growing up, and
right.
sort of validates that. What I didn't want that to be is, you're a creative genius, as am I.
And you're a lot like me. Yeah, it's tricky. It's always really hard to navigate that. I have certain comedians who, it's the same thing like you say, like you recognize the rhythms of your thoughts in what they do, or that it comes from the same place, or it feels like, do you know Sean Morley?
I know of him from the research I've done of you.
Right, he's a wonderful comedian. He does stuff that's completely different to what I do. It's much more freeform and kind of macabre and sort of kind of horror themed almost. He's really, really wonderful. But a lot of sometimes you just recognize certain tones or moods or whatever, or just like values, and you go, I feel like this person is approaching this from the same place as me. And it feels really hard to talk to them about that at the same time as you're saying, I think you're brilliant. Because, yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is, I'm brilliant too. We should bond over how brilliant we both are. But no, I know what you mean. Like, you can admire somebody's work while also recognizing the currents that you share with it without that necessarily being a narcissistic thing to do, I think.
Oh, totally. I'm glad that has been conveyed and it's not purely sort of egomaniacism.
Yeah.
In addition to all the deep and sincere connections, the thing that struck me particularly hard was when we were growing up, we both, for a short period at least, wanted to be Pierce Brosnan. What?
Did you have that?
I had that.
Weird.
I've never found that in someone else too.
Wow. You've also done a deep dive. I can't remember what it was I talked about that in.
Oh, I bugged your
Q&A
for the last few months. I thought that was cool.
Right.
Stu Goldsmith you mentioned.
Yes, yeah, that's the one.
Just for the completists out there.
Yeah, I have a very vivid memory of being I was very kind of off in my own head a lot as a kid, and if there were any sort of like family walks, I tended to just be off out front or off behind and kind of creating my own sort of narrative. And for some reason, a lot of them involved basically kind of casting myself as James Bond, but specifically Brosnan's Bond. And I think specifically Brosnan, I think not even, because I think Mrs. Doubtfire came into it as well. I think just generally he was a figure I admired a lot and sort of projected my future self into. I couldn't tell you why, except that I still have a huge amount of, have you seen the Eurovision movie from last year?
Yes. I forgot he was in that, but yes.
I mean, he is garbage in it. Like his accent is just all over the place, and yet there's something just very magnetic about the guy. I feel like he's one of those people who's aware of his limitations as an actor. Like, I think he's a good actor, but I think he knows exactly where the ceiling is, and then he becomes very comfortable within that ceiling, and there's something very charming about it. Got a lot of time for the guy. Also, Mamma Mia, I think his performance in Mamma Mia is one of the funniest performances anyone's ever put to screen. It's so earnest, and there's no need for it to be so earnest in such a stupid film, but he really, like, plays the truth of it, and I find that very funny.
I think the singing in Mamma Mia is perhaps where he found the ceiling.
Yeah, that was probably the point where he went, oh, I can't do this. That is too high.
He's also a fantastic artist, it's transpired, which I didn't know.
Is he? I didn't know that.
It was...
Visual artist.
A painter, as in proper sort of old school, literally.
Oh, cool.
And it just popped up on his Insta stories one time. And he's fantastic. And he seems to have covered every different type of art from sort of Roy Lichtenstein, like pot prints, and then this fantastic somewhere between Dali and Miro hallucinations.
Oh, wow.
Like he's gone for a sort of like a drugged walk through a desert and kind of weird. And I didn't.
Oh, I'm going to have to look that up.
Do. It's phenomenal.
He's up there with Hugh Grant, I think, for me, in terms of these actors who I think were written off a lot in the 90s as being quite shallow, superficial actors who were just sort of attractive in something, attractive and kind of competent, and then coasting on that. And I think only as they've got older have we realised that, like, the fact that they were able to kind of accept whatever their limits were actually made them really great. And I think now there's this big sort of cult of Hugh Grant, which I'm very much a member of, and I think we should extend it to Brosnan. I think the two of them have really kind of grown into themselves as they've got older. I've got a lot of time for the two.
I couldn't agree more. And yet, like you said before, that it's hard to pinpoint exactly why he's so good. It's sort of, he's enigmatically charismatic.
Yeah. Did you watch the, have you seen the making of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves documentary that Pierce Brosnan presents?
I haven't, but
it's wonderful. He's got this sort of long hair and glasses and this leather jacket. And I think it was just pre-fame, or it was just as he was becoming like a phenomenon. So it was around the time that he was doing little cameos in movies, but I don't think he'd been like a leading man yet. And he just carries himself with all the kind of swagger and arrogance of like, I'm going to be a big deal in this decade. And he was right. So it's a gamble that pays off. But you watch it and it's like, this guy is... he's really gambling on his own success, and it's ridiculous. It's very Partridge. It's got the vibe of a kind of ridiculous, like, he sort of strolls towards camera in this leather jacket and goes, Robin of Sherwood was a... It's great. I can't do it justice.
That was a good Brosnan. That was a good
Brosnan
impression.
It's better to just watch it. He does it so well himself that there's no need for me to try. He's wonderful.
But this might turn... this whole podcast might turn into just a Brosnan fan club.
Oh, yeah, I could.
I feel like there should be.
Yeah.
I to this day, whenever I sprint down a road, it's the opening scene from GoldenEye in my head, where he's running on the dam.
Do you know what? I've never seen GoldenEye.
What?
I know, and I claim to be a huge Brosnan fan. It's a gap.
You go
it's
to
a gap.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves subsidiary making documentary before GoldenEye.
Yeah, I've not seen that one good film that everybody agrees he's good at.
Just big Remington Steele fan. Just one part.
Oh, that's it. That's where he came from, isn't it? I think it's, that's around the same time as the Robin Hood thing, I think. But I couldn't remember what it was called. Never seen that either.
I don't think even the editor did. I think it's just folklore.
Yeah.
Which fits in well with Robin Hood. You've such a fantastic back catalogue of hour-long comedy shows, of short films, of sketches, now a movie-length version of a show you were planning to do live but made into a cinematic piece. What, in your view, is the difference between a short film and a sketch, and what constitutes a good one of either?
I think the key difference is story, really. I think this is a big difference that I've been thinking about a lot in the last year, because I'm currently kind of in the process of trying to get back into doing more short film stuff, because I feel like it hasn't really been available to us over the last year. I feel like the kind of comedy output that people have had has been very restricted to what they can do by themselves in their homes or over Zoom with other people. So you're very limited to this kind of front-facing, talking into the camera thing. Either you have to play all the characters, or it has to be done with very clear jump cuts of like, and now we're in the other person's home over Zoom or whatever. So that sort of limits the format, and it means you can't really tell a story unless you build the format into the story. So it's like Zoom is a part of how it's told. So I think what you lose is the idea of like, what's the word? Sort of that kind of storytelling where you're showing something unfold as it actually happened. Like, you're not using the format of sketch comedy and jump cuts and Zoom and that kind of thing to tell it, but you're able to actually get more than one person in a room and do something that's about the characters and about their relationships, and you can show a scene play out. So I guess one of the key differences there is just length. I think a short film is... I think a sketch tends to explore all its ideas within 2 or 3 minutes, because it doesn't have to go anywhere. It doesn't have to develop. It just has to say, this is the idea. We're playing with the idea as much as we can in this time, and then we stop, and then we're out, and we've done the thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas a short film, I think, inherently has to be about starting somewhere and going somewhere else and bringing those characters with you, which I guess means, I mean, there are some great short films that are a minute long or 2 minutes long or whatever, but I guess it's going to tend to drift towards that sort of 5-7 minute mark, depending on how much mileage you've got in the thing. But yeah, I think that's the big thing I've missed over the last year, is just being able to make stuff where the focus isn't necessarily on, I've had this one funny observation and I want to play with it. It's more about, I have these characters and I want to put these characters through through a process, and I want to sort of tell that story from beginning to end. So I'm trying to do more of that sort of thing now and get people in a room and go, right, what can we, where can we take this, and what's the funny thing to happen to these people? So yeah, telling stories about characters rather than about a single idea, I guess.
A fantastic explanation of the two. I was struggling to find an immediate follow-up question because it's very comprehensive. In an interview you gave a couple of years ago, you quote Kurt Vonnegut's book, Breakfast with Champions.
Oh, yeah.
In which he says, and I quote from him, when he was giving an explanation of why he's writing the book, I think I'm trying to clear my head of all that junk in there. I'm trying to make my head as empty as it was when I was born onto this damaged planet 50 years ago. And you say that's a pretty good encapsulation of how you approach stand-up and idea creation.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I think so. I think I still think about that sentence a lot. Like, I really, I divide a lot of what I'm trying to, of what I've been trying to do over the last however many years into basically before and after I read that book, because I think it explains things so well. And I think, yeah, there's, I think all ideas is about clearing out what's in there. I think in the context of that book, he's talking about it as though, like, he's very dismissive of Breakfast of Champions. And I think when he did his rankings of his own work, he gave it a B minus or something, even though I think it's the best book ever written. And I think that's because it's inherently like, he saw it all as sort of fluff. It was just taking the top layer off what was there and saying, this happens and then this happens and then this happens and then this happens. So none of it really is a fully rounded story in the way that like Slaughterhouse-Five is or something. But I think that in the process of doing that, he just makes something that's really very, very pure. And it's the kind of core elements of what creating things is. I think there are different kinds of ideas. Like, I think you can make some shows that are very much just about, I need to get this stuff out and I need to find a way of voicing it, and that's enough. And then I think there are others where you can recognize, actually, what I've got here is the center of a story and I need to think about that and develop it and take it further. So I've not actually reread it in a long time. It's still kind of the philosophy of it, I think, is still very much the center of everything I go back to. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether if I looked at it now, I would find that there are limits to it in the same way that he thought there were at the time, because I guess the more you go back to something, the more you start to notice things about it. But I still think it's such a great summing up of like what we're trying to do in making stuff is, yeah, you're trying to kind of reclaim that sort of wonder that you have as a child. And to do that, you need to just clear everything that occurs to you and go, here's a bit of rubbish that's accumulated, here's another bit of rubbish. So basically therapy. I'm just describing the therapy process, I guess. But we choose to do it in public, therefore we're artists or whatever.
The amount of comedians who have referred to comedy as therapy is,
yeah.
Well, it's not a Venn diagram, it's a circle. That does seem, yeah, to be the
yeah, everybody's aware of that role that it plays. I think one of the big things, this was Stu Goldsmith actually who pointed this out to me, that I think one of the most important things you can do when you're making work that is therapeutic in that way is to remember to remove yourself at the last minute. Because there's this idea that like therapeutic comedy is very powerful because it speaks to these feelings that everybody has and everybody recognizes themselves in it. But when you have those shows that are very like, they're very unburdening and they're very like, and now let me tell you the core of my trauma and what that did to me and all that kind of thing. I think often that's them putting that onto the audience and assuming that they need to know everything about your situation. And a lot of the time they don't. They just need the feelings sketched in so that they go, yeah, I recognize that. So Stu came to see a show of mine once, the Mr. Fruit Salad show that I did in 2019. And it had a lot of like confessional stuff and a lot of, and the reason why I'm doing this is actually because, and like telling them everything. And he went, you can get rid of all that. It already does all that without you needing to say what happened to you. So I think that's all. I think everybody uses comedy as therapy, but I think the hard bit is remembering that you don't need to tell them everything. You can kind of tell them as much as you need to for them to understand it, and then you can tell them no more, because it's not actually about your trauma. It's about their feelings, I think. Something like that.
Totally, totally. And I know you've said before how abstract comedy or absurdist comedy is very good at conveying that. It made me remember there was a study a few years ago where they found that, I think I'm getting this right, that when you have multilingual people think of something, if they think of it in a language that is an additional language to their native one, they'll be much less nuanced and much more prescriptivist, as opposed to if you think of something in your native language, even though you can do it fluently, you can sort of understand the nuance more. And I think the reason is that in those cases, they'll be thinking about the language choice rather than this sort of abstract idea. And so it follows that abstract absurdist comedy is better. If you label a thought, it defines and constrains the thought as much as explaining it. So it makes sense that to explain something abstract, you need an abstract medium. So that.
Well, it's like every time you map something on to anything else, you lose part. Like, I found out the word qualia this year, and I now love the word qualia, and it just means, like your impression of what the color red looks like, or your version of what sand feels like under your feet, or whatever. And the fact that to you, that's always going to have a slightly different connection of meanings and networks and things than what it will be for me. And I can never understand yours, and you can never understand mine. So every time we kind of map a feeling onto a physical thing, we lose a little bit of what it is anyway. And I think that's very true with language, that we have all these ideas of like, that word represents all this stuff to me, but would represent a slightly different series of things to somebody else. So absurdism, is as close as you can get to that sense of just going, this is the feeling. I'm just putting the feeling into this nonsense thing, because that's, to me, what it means, and I hope you get it as well. Whereas as soon as you're adapting things to language and to sentences and to logic, there's always the possibility for that, for the center of it to be lost in translation in some way.
Sure. And so would you say
we would all just sort of grunt on stage and kind of wave things, and the audience would understand exactly what's being said. But sadly, we all have too much emotional baggage for that to ever really work. So in some way, we have to use words, but ideally, we'd just get rid of them.
I'm sure there's at least 5 acts at any given Edinburgh Fringe that just do
that. Basically do that, that go, whoa! And everyone goes, wow, I really understood that.
Exactly, 4 stars.
Yeah.
So would you say that because you invoke a lot of images and characters and stories and sketches in your stand-up, would it be fair to say it's akin to symbolism, or is that a reach?
I don't know enough about the word symbolism kind of academic way, because I think in terms of my gut feeling is, I guess like you use a certain piece of music or a certain image or a certain connection to represent something that you can't represent in another way. But I think I don't know enough about, because it's a Russian thing, isn't it? Symbolism, the Russian symbolists. Is that a thing?
It sounds like it's a thing. I wasn't aware of
it. I feel like I remember it from I read a lot of Russian stuff in my 20s because I really liked The Master and Margarita. And I got a bit carried away and went and read a load of Russian. And I think there's a thing about the Russian symbolists, and I cannot remember a thing about them. So I feel under-equipped to fully say, yes, my work has a symbolist streak, because I have no idea what I'm talking about. But I think the idea that that you create stuff by making these connections that only you can make, and that to you, if you put this image together with this sound, it suddenly feels like this. And then giving that to the audience and seeing whether they find that funny or find that insightful or interesting, and just sort of leave that up to them. I think I think that's a key thing I go back to, is just, to me, this felt right, so I mashed it up, and I hope that it feels right to you as well. But then also actually, like, it, because it's comedy, it doesn't need to feel right to the audience, because I think a big thing about what makes absurdist comedy different to a lot of other art forms. Like, I have a friend who makes amazing conceptual theatre shows. Her name's Grace Gibson. She's really wonderful. And she makes these shows that are just sort of strange images where she's a bush that has a nosebleed. And then she has to carry cushions on her head and stuff. And it's, if I saw a comedian doing it, like a kind of absurdist comedian like Michael Brunstrom or whatever, I would find it hilarious. And when I see her doing exactly the same thing, I find it very interesting because it's always about, I put these strange things together because to me it says something profound, and therefore you kind of receive it as something profound. And then somebody else can say, I put these strange things together because I think it's silly. And then you go, okay, cool. It's stupid. I understand. So I think, yeah, like the intention behind a strange decision is as important as the decision itself. And it changes the way people receive it because it means they can go, that is stupid. I don't understand it and it's stupid. Therefore it's funny. Or people can go, whoa, wow, I wouldn't have thought of that. So now I'm interested and I see the world from your perspective or whatever. Or it can be somewhere in the middle, which I think is the best place to be.
Totally. And I remember seeing Master and Margarita as a play when I was in a...
Where did you see it?
I would have been around GCSE time, and it was...
It wasn't Poole, was it?
I think it might have been Poole.
Oh. That production is a big part of like why I ended up going into performance and stuff. I can't remember if it was Poole or Chichester. It was the Lighthouse Theatre, and I can't remember if that's in Poole or Chichester. I think it's Poole.
I saw Simon Amstell at the Lighthouse, and I can't. Right. The image I have of where we were sitting doesn't seem to match with the Lighthouse Poole, and yet I'm from that region, so I don't know.
Maybe it was Chichester. Was it, they have Michael Feast as the devil, a bald guy, and Samuel West as the master.
I didn't know it to that extent, because we weren't told what it was about. And
you'll figure it out.
Exactly. And it was insane and incredible, and genuinely the first time I saw a naked woman was in that play.
Yeah, so yeah, that's a great bit.
It has resonance.
Very memorable.
That weirdly stuck out to me more than the names of the actors. I should have that.
I just tried to take it all in. I'll take in this sort of sexual awakening, but also I want to know the name of that guy playing the devil. Exactly. I need it all. It's all like the information.
Like when watching The Mask the first time.
Yeah.
Cameron Diaz, but also think about the
cinematography. This guy's great.
you mentioned music in that, and you are alike to Quentin Tarantino in at least one way that I have found, is that you both write your stuff to music.
Oh, interesting. Does he do that?
Apparently he gets a lot of albums and just sits down and listens to them all and thinks, what would be a good scene for this? And then that's how he comes up with the idea of a film.
Yeah.
And that is seemingly how you write.
I think I have an identical thing where I just walk around whatever kind of green space is near me, and I put on, it's usually just whatever I'm listening to at the moment, but sometimes it'll be a specific song that I'm like, wait, I'm in the mood for that. That's the mood I want. Mm-hmm. So if that song is like the what's the word? The kind of conduit for that mood, then whatever I end up writing also has to be a conduit for the same mood. So it's all sort of written to that. And sometimes that doesn't make it into the actual show. Sometimes it's just that song helped me work out what mood I wanted to put into the thing I was writing. But very often the song ends up being a part of the thing as well. So it'll be in there in the show. I have worked out actually from the film last year, because I did the live show that was cancelled that then got adapted into a film. And that was the first time I've learned that the song isn't necessarily a key part of the thing, because for that we had to replace all the music with rights-free stuff from the internet, because obviously it was being distributed in a different way. And when it's live, you can get away with stuff through PRS and that sort of thing. But when it's a recording, like a recorded thing that you're selling as a download, there's a lot more rights issues and things. Mm-hmm. So all the songs that were kind of the soundtracks to key bits of the show, I had to replace with things that sounded like it. And I was so resistant to it. I was so annoyed when this was explained to me. And I was like, but I think that's a really important bit of how I work and how my brain works and how it gets these things in there. And then it turned out, as long as you find something else that feels the same, you go, oh no, that's all right. Or I think if you've been successful, then you can do that. Like if you've successfully managed to channel what you took from the song into the writing, then you can then swap the song out for another and it feels the same. I guess if you're 100% reliant on the original track, then it means that, again, something's got lost in the translation over. It's something is still in that song that you didn't manage to put into the show. Mm-hmm. But hopefully if you've done it right, you can just have a suggestion of the mood rather than having to directly recreate the mood via somebody else's copyrighted work. Because ideally, like, I recognize that it's not good that I'm often reliant on stuff other people have made in order to show what I'm doing. But I'm gradually learning to maybe be slightly less reliant on it than I have been.
Sure. Yes, it's so long as the joke doesn't involve the words Van Morrison.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, then you can. Yeah, that's where I've run into trouble before, is where people have said, we're going to have to cut that Van Morrison bit. And I go, no, no way. He needs to be in it.
Well, he always is in spirit, if not necessarily.
Yeah. He's watching over. He's got a new album out at the moment. Apparently, it's 2 hours long. It's called Latest Record Project, Volume 1. And it's just 2 hours of him moaning about lockdown and about how everybody always tells him his old stuff was better than his new stuff and everyone's always ripping him off. And it's such a sad thing to see because he genuinely used to be this really like kind of mystic songwriter. And I think he did a lot of this, like you put a mood into what you do and then it gets distorted, but you sort of feel it as a listener. And these days he's just mad. He's just a lunatic old man. And it's reassuring in a way to see that even the people who at one point were kind of profoundly talented at this sort of like magic that you do when you make stuff can still end up being sort of talentless hacks. It's quite nice to remember that we're all good and terrible at different stages in our life.
Yeah, well, hopefully he's doing the Joaquin Phoenix thing where when he was promoting a movie, he appeared on David Letterman as a sort of washed out version of himself.
Oh, really?
So that they could. Because they wanted to do like a fake documentary of Joaquin Phoenix if he was a washed out version of himself, and they, in order to not have to pay David Letterman, he just went on his show as the real version but in this guise, and then they just used the clip from the show as though it was reality.
So that's maybe, really smart.
Maybe that is what Van's doing.
Yeah, he could be doing a really long game, and one day he'll release a really beautiful album that he was tricking us into believing would never exist again. But I think he might have just gone mad.
Potentially.
I guess. There's still time for him to reveal his master plan.
Yeah, Andy Kaufman or just depression. That's a game show.
Yeah.
You mentioned in terms of using music in the shows, and your 2016 show, I really loved.
Thank you.
It uses narrative in... It's the underlying narrative of the show is the concept of a narrative itself, and you subvert those. It's a very awkward way of explaining it. You can likely do a better job.
So the idea with that show, it was called Hello Goodbye, and it was about finding people and it was about losing people. And basically, I mean, the narrative was more a sort of thing to hang different skits off, and each skit sort of represented some sort of mood I'd been in or some thought I'd had or idea I'd had during the year. But the basic narrative of it was that year I had met my girlfriend at the time and my granddad had died. So that had been the two key events of this year, was that I had lost somebody and I had found somebody. So at the start, I explained that the narrative of the show was that the two main characters were my granddad and my girlfriend at the time, and one of them was going to die by the end, and one of them I was going to fall in love with, but I left it as a twist to guess which was which obviously the audience knows where it's heading, but every time I introduced either of them again, there was a sort of, is she going to die, and am I going to fall in love with my granddad? That was the sort of question. So yeah, toying with the idea of jeopardy in the narrative when everybody knows there is no jeopardy and they go, we know this is a dead granddad show and a boo-hoo, my granddad died or whatever. And then I met somebody nice, hooray. Like everybody knows what the end point is, but you pretend that getting to that end point is in any way unpredictable or surprising when actually we all know this stuff is on rails because we know the story of every Edinburgh show. Like all Edinburgh shows are just... And I guess that's when I realized that it was the journey that, it's all the same stuff that we go up with every year.
Yeah, the it seems to be around the 45 minute mark of the hour.
Yes.
You get the sucker punch, to quote Siegfried.
Yeah. Which is supposedly, I think, just about attention spans, isn't it? I think that's why that's become such a cliche, is that, like, people think in 20 minute attention spans. So they have, you have a 20 minute act. And I think this is true in film as well, that each act tends to be about 20 minutes to half an hour. And when you get to the end of the second block, you've had two 20 minute blocks of funny, and that's kind of, you need a gear change at that next one. So people tend to use that gear change as a, like, now it's time to lower the mood and think about what we've learned and all the things that are sad as well as the things that are funny. And then you pull it back with a big sort of big finale. I can't remember who it was. I think it was Ben Targe, but I may be wrong. Maybe it's a different comedian, but I'm pretty certain Ben Targe did a show where he started by talking about the very, very sad trauma that had informed the show, and then did 50 minutes of just funny nonsense. He was like, you all know that there is a sad trauma in this show that I'm going to talk about that has informed all my silliness. So let's do, I think it was Ben Targe, and I think it was a death, a very upsetting death of a friend that he talked about in the first 5 minutes of the show. And the audience goes, oh my God. And he goes, right, let's have fun for 50 minutes. And it's an excuse to then go, I actually just want you guys to have a great time. I don't need you to be burdened by that. So let's get it out of the way. It was very funny.
I've never encountered that before, but I'm surprised that's not been a thing before, because it's such a brilliant idea.
It's a great idea. It's good ones like that.
And confusing for people coming in 6 minutes late, but fine.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And also for anybody not hugely familiar with the structure of an Edinburgh show, they're just going to come in and go, sorry, what? You're going to start with what?
They thought it was still just a cafe, and
yeah.
They went on a trip. In my research review, I found a fantastic sketch review you did in 2014 called Jos Norris Single Father, which is a fantastically written, fantastically acted sketch.
Oh, thank you.
You're very welcome.
That was my first good thing, I think, that sketch.
Really? Okay.
I think so.
Well, it certainly was a good thing. So that's interesting. It's the first one you considered. So it's apparently filmed, coincidentally, by a fellow Spieling the Beans guest, Charlie Dinkin.
Charlie Dinkin. Yeah, we were both kind of starting out in comedy around the same time, and she was looking more at sort of writing and directing. And I occasionally had sort of sketch ideas, and she had a camera, so she helped out and kind of directed them and helped me work out how to put them on camera, because I was very much plugged into doing stand-up at the time and I kind of wanted to go into film and into more visual scripted stuff, but didn't really know how, so she sort of helped me out for a bit. So she was great. She was really helpful at that. We tried to write something together around the same time, which went horribly wrong, because I had never collaborated before and sort of panicked and was a very, very bad collaborator. So we sort of stopped making stuff together quite so much. And then more recently, time goes by and you realize how to get better at, like, recognizing the things that you messed up with. So I'm now sort of helping her out a bit more with some of these sketches she's doing for Channel 4 and for Pulped. I've acted in a couple of those, and it's really nice, like, working with her again, because she was a really great help in those sort of early years, like learning how to take my ideas and put them on screen like that. She's fantastic, really great.
Oh, lovely. And so it's almost, in essence, that you had a reunion then. I was going to say it was a reunion via podcast.
Nice to be back on the same thing as her.
Exactly, and a reunion in multiple ways, because the crux of that sketch is that you're looking forward to being divorced in the future.
Yes,
Not that you were married at the time, I assume.
No, I wasn't. I had still never had a relationship at the time, but my parents got divorced when I was very young, and more recently, both my parents have asked me, like, I hope you were all right about that. Like, did that cause any damage or whatever? And I was so small that I genuinely don't think it did cause damage. I didn't have a sense of, like, my world was this and then it was broken and changed into this, which I think some people have when they're older. But I guess what it did do is, like, change my worldview, because it has just meant that I have this understanding that, like, a acrimonious divorce with all the kind of recriminations and the guilt and stuff is an inherently, like, quite exciting thing to look forward to. And a part of me is like, yeah, that'd be great. That's just part of life. So I'm sure that'll happen to me and that'd be lovely. So it was this sketch about looking forward to that day. We've actually just, my girlfriend and I have just written, just made a short film that's about exactly the same concept, because it was a thing that it's a thing that crops up in my writing every now and again, that when I talked to her about it, she was like, this is funny, we could do a little story about this. So it's a story about a couple that role plays the idea of going through a very sad divorce, as though it's really exciting because they're bonded over this strange fantasy. So yeah, it crops up more often than it should in my writing, really, that every few years I go, I'm going to make something about how divorce is good again. It's about time.
Well, that's a Spilling the Beans exclusive, then. That is a scoop.
Yeah, I don't know when it'll be out, but Matthew Heighton has directed it for us, and it's got Rufus Hound in it as a little cameo. He very kindly popped in to do a little bit, so hopefully it'll be a fun thing when we're finished with it.
Well, it sounds like it. It has all the ingredients. I fully expect the final meal to live up. I mentioned reunions because that was one of the first good thing that you did.
And yeah.
In a podcast you did about a few weeks ago, you talked about that you have this fantasy just before you go to bed, not one of those, but the idea of being shipwrecked on a beach, not for the peace, but for the reunion afterwards.
Yeah.
What
is it about
the idea of a reunion that so intrigues and maybe borderline obsesses you?
I think I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I think it plays into how I feel about social media. Because I think one of the things that occurs to me a lot when I think about this stuff is that what I would really like, and it's a stupid thing to be obsessed by because it's a thing you can give yourself permission to do whenever you want. But I think what I would really like a lot of the time is like permission to have a very quiet, small life where you're not on show all the time and you're not needing to kind of put all your thoughts and opinions out into the world. But I've chosen a career where that is what you do. It's part of what you do is you go, hey, here I am. Here's my new thing. Here's my new project, which is about how I feel or what I am. And I think a part of me really hates that about like being in the arts, that you need to be on show all the time and you need to feel like your opinions and your feelings are kind of public property in some way and that you need to get them out there all the time. So I have had this obsession very often in my sort of daydreams and things about going off up to a desert island and the reunion afterwards or just being cut off and isolated for a long time. And I guess that's because somewhere in my relationship with what I do, there is this weird push and pull between like privacy and isolation and just wanting to be allowed to go off and be by myself and think versus the need to show people what I'm doing and show people what I'm thinking. And you sort of have to have this belief in some way that the stuff you're making is valuable and means something, because otherwise why would you do it? So yeah, trying to measure that versus the like, I actually just want to kind of be small and quiet and show stuff to people when I have stuff to show it. I think that's a real to and fro. I guess that's why the Bo Burnham comparison is interesting, because obviously that's such a theme of Inside, the new special. So I watched that and just was very like, wow, this is all the stuff I've been thinking for the last few years as well, but obviously done so much better than I am able to. But I think, again, yeah, you spot those things where the same sort of currents of thought are recurring. And I think that show expresses that really well, that sort of the desire to just be insular and quiet and private about your life versus the desire for like reward and validation and stuff from other people with what you do. And I guess the key is just trying to make sure that everything you make does something as well as stokes your sort of desire for ego validation and stuff. Like obviously that's an inherent part of making things, is that you want people to pat you on the back and say, well done, that was good. But you've really got to sit and look at your ideas to say, is this doing anything else? Is this going to do something that makes other people go, great, that expressed a new thought for me or made me think in a new way? And if you can try and do that more often, then maybe that's a way of navigating that relationship, because it's a really hard thing when you're reliant on the opinions of other people but you sort of don't want them.
Totally. And there does seem to be this continuing thread throughout sort of all of performance history that to perform is a way of controlling the narrative, controlling the conversation.
Yeah,
you could do things in a very specific way, And I'm glad the Bo Burnham comparison rings true in that, because that's what I was getting when you were saying that, about how he was... I'm still amazed that he's able to sit on all of the stuff he made and only release it at the end and not go... I've made a really good, like, white woman's Instagram. He could have put that at any point.
Yeah, you'd think, and that would be a huge viral hit. But then it wouldn't have been part of this amazing thing that he made over however many months or years or whatever. Like, I'm sure some of that stuff dates back to pre-pandemic, and it was things he was writing in the 5 years since he stopped performing. I'm sure it wasn't the product of just 1 year in lockdown, but the thinking that went into it will have been years of thinking. Mm. So I think, that sense of taking the time to go away and make something that is a coherent whole that then has a real impact, rather than breaking it down into here's my little thought on this thing and here's my little thought on this thing, I think really has rewards.
Totally. And that feeds into something I know you've been really interested in recently, which is the idea of short feedback loops and long feedback loops.
Yeah, this was there was a blog by, I think his name's Lee Krasner, was the guy who wrote the article where I first read about this. But the idea is that short feedback loops is the work where the gap between you having the idea and you getting the feedback on the idea is as short as possible. And long feedback loops are where you're working on something for months, years at a time, and you're not going to see any reward or even like acknowledgement of the work until a very long way down the line. And the idea is that we're becoming very addicted to short feedback loops because they're very easy and they're very satisfying, because you can have an idea. I mean, I think this is very true of live, that like, as a live comedian, the feedback loop is instantaneous, because you say something and it gets a laugh or it doesn't. So you go, okay, that worked or that didn't work. So it's always like instant. And now, because of online, comedy's moved online, and you can have an idea and tweet it that day or make it into a sketch and tweet it the next day and get that feedback of what the internet made of it. So that's a sort of instantaneous loop. But the more meaningful work that you do, like, those are really fun. I make stuff like that as well myself, and it's really satisfying to have an idea and then the next day tweet it out and people go, haha, great. Yeah. Like, it feels nice. But the meaningful work you do is always going to be a result of long feedback loops. And the risk is that, because it is an addiction, like, the more addicted we get to it, the harder it is to train your brain out of it, so that we're getting to the point where when you're trying to work on something that inherently has a long feedback loop to it, it becomes like physically painful to put up with. You sort of think, I'm used to having an idea and then being able to be told that my idea is good or bad or otherwise. And I'm sitting with this thing that I'm not going to see anything for it for 6 months, a year, 2 years or whatever. And it becomes harder and harder to tell your brain and your body to persist with that, and to know that at the end you're going to have something that has benefited from your time and your care. So I think it's an addiction to be sort of mindful of at the moment, and to try and recognize, because I have it as well. I look at social media way more than I should, and sometimes I try to come up with ideas for the sake of having an idea of like, oh, I ought to come up with a sketch to tweet or whatever. And I think the more energy you give those short feedback loops, the harder it makes it for you to benefit from the work that you sort of cultivate, like a gardener.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
Totally. Yes, go ahead.
No, oh, no, sorry. That's it. Pretty okay. much. Those are my thoughts.
I totally agree. And you've written before how, in terms of, it was specifically about the audience shift, and how institutions like the BBC and Channel 4 and other ones like that have been looking to reach very, very hyper short content in order to reach TikTok audiences, and the danger therein of stopping themselves from being able to do what they do well, which is longer form.
I think
style.
It's a risk, because like, there's have you seen Please Like, Liam Williams's sitcom?
I haven't yet.
It's about YouTube and TikTok, and Liam plays a very kind of out of touch, grouchy comedian who doesn't know how social media works, who then talks to YouTubers, and there's all these jokes in it where he's making this documentary for BBC Three, and all these YouTubers go see the cameras and go, oh, is this, what's this for? And he goes, it's a documentary for BBC. And all the YouTubers go, oh, I'm not interested. And it's sort of funny recurring gag in that show. But I think actually, like, a lot of the people that love that kind of content aren't excited by the idea of the BBC or TV or whatever. So, like, if they try too hard to chase after that audience, like, that audience already gets the thing that they want. It gets it straight on their phone every day, kind of as often as they want. Mm. So if it tries too hard to mimic that, then I think it loses what it's really good at. Like, I think a lot of people get very frustrated by TV and radio because it's so slow. Like, you can be working on an idea for over a year before somebody even tells you whether you're going to get to make it or not. And then you've got to make it, which takes another year or whatever. And it is frustrating. And TV and radio need to recognize, like, what's going on with people's attitudes and what sort of content they like. And they need to respond to that and be relevant and all that kind of thing. But I think they also need to not lose sight of the fact that those things take a very long time means they're really good. Like, it means that you get at the end things like I May Destroy You or This Way Up or Flowers or all these shows that are made with real love and care and that people sat with for a very, very long time. I don't think we're at the point where actually the people who run TV are considering no longer making good quality TV shows. I think it's possible to overstate the kind of the concerns about it. But I do think, yeah, when I see commissioners reaching very hard to try and kind of get exciting influencer talent on board, I kind of think, but that's not, they already have their audience. They reach more people through the internet than anybody else. And I think I think those people have got to remember that the thing that TV and radio really ought to be good at is telling stories in a bigger way and in a slower way and in a more crafted way. Like, that's what it's always been great at. But I might be wrong. I might be completely wrong. It might be there's a huge sea change going on and that TV will become a place for quicker, shorter content like that. And I'll sort of go, oh, right, okay, this is what it is now. I might be being too resistant to it. I'm not sure. But those are my sort of gut feelings about it.
I think you're right with that. And if it were to get more hyper short, I think what would then happen is you'd have people a bit like those who want... craft ales sort of were old-fashioned, didn't care about those in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then they all went away, and then people went, hey, what about these craft ales? And I think if mainstream becomes super short, people are going, oh, you should check this thing out. It's 9 hours long. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, there'll be a weird sort of boom for retro content where people watch films and go, yeah, this film is like over an hour long. And people go, what? I can't believe it. People used to sit down for an hour and watch one thing on one screen. And people have kind of reenactment nights where they remember what it was like to watch long stuff.
We'll play this back in 20 years and it will sound like when Tomorrow's World say you could have a computer that's even smaller than a room.
Yeah.
There's one thing you wrote about that, which was you should follow the individual needs of the idea rather than to think what route will most achieve popularity. And you've spoken similarly around writing a story that's bigger than yourself. And it's this idea of putting the idea ahead of either the idea ahead of the person, be that the audience or the creator.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the thing. It's always about, like, I recognize that sometimes I have a really dumb idea that has no depth. You know, I'll have a silly idea and I'll go, well, all that needs to be is a silly thing I put on social media and it can do well or badly or it doesn't matter. And then other times I have an idea where I go, that's the starting point of something interesting and something that could go somewhere and say something about a character or whatever. And yeah, the other thing was writing a script where I spent so many years writing scripts basically about me and about, here's something that's sort of loosely based on my experience or is based on my viewpoint or my kind of my life. And then more recently started writing scripts where I thought, I'll tell a great story first. And then who knows, maybe if I'm a good choice to play, if it ever gets made and I'm a good choice to play a character in it, then fantastic. I like writing and performing, so it would be nice to. But when you can get to a point where your writing isn't purely about serving yourself, but it's more about what does the idea need? What does the main character need to be in order for this story to work? Because that was the script I wrote for that was, there's a great theory at Pixar where Pixar are really great at pointing out that their main characters are always the worst possible character for this story to happen to. Like, they think about what is the theme of the film and what character is the opposite of that. So if the theme of the example was Finding Nemo. And like, if the theme about that is about letting go and learning to kind of lose stuff and that you don't have control over stuff, then the main character has to be so controlling and so paranoid about ever losing control. So that was the same sort of thing, was the main character of the script I wrote. Whereas I normally write characters very much based on me and kind of they're a bit awkward and hopeless and like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing and I'm making it up as I go along and I'm a bit chaotic and silly and incompetent. But I realized that the story I was telling needed a very paranoid control freak character, I guess similar to Finding Nemo, actually. But I've ripped off Finding Nemo is what I've done. So, yeah, it was sort of learning to go, this doesn't need to be me, this character. This can just be the right character for the story. And learning to remove yourself in that way, I think, is only for the benefit of the thing.
Well, that's brilliant. And I hope to see that script come to life.
Who knows? We'll see. It's one of those, maybe one day in a year or two or 10 or 20, maybe sure. I'll get to make it. I like it a lot, but it's again, like, it is a slow process getting these things made. And so much of it is down to things outside of your control, like what's in the kind of zeitgeist at the moment and what people are looking to make. It would be lovely to make it at some point because it's a script I'm really proud of, but I'm not expecting to do it tomorrow or the next day. So I'll see about the day after that.
Yeah,
that's
Friday,
when I'll start considering it. Yeah.
Okay. What would you say would be the best advice you've received, and what would you say would be the worst advice you've received?
The best advice I've received was from John Kearns in 2008. John Kearns is a comedian, really, really fantastic comedian. I think probably still my favourite, but he's the guy who got me into it, so I have a vested interest. But he was a friend at uni who helped me get my first gigs. And we went up to the Fringe in 2008 and just messed around and had a go at some gigs and tried to work out if it was something we wanted to do or not. And he sat me down towards the end of that Fringe and said, you could do this if you wanted, but you have to really want to. And I said, oh, well, I do want to. So that's good. And he said, well, you have to want to. And there can't be anything you're trying to get out of it. You can't be trying to get somewhere. And you have to do it in a way where if it all went to absolute shit, you wouldn't do it any differently. You have to be doing it because you need to do it and there's nothing else you could do. And I think in a way, that's a very dramatic kind of, it's the way that teenagers talk about comedy when they're getting involved about like, no, it's my soul. I have to, like, realistically, of course, nobody has to do it. Everyone can go and get a job doing something else. But you have to have that belief, I think, that it's not about where you're trying to get to or what you're trying to be given for it. It's a part of how you process the world and process your experience of the world. I do this anyway, you know, regardless of what happens or whether I get anything from it, it has to be part of what you're doing anyway. And the worst advice I've ever received, that's quite hard because I think, like, unless you're fundamentally unhappy with where you've ended up, it's quite hard to point at things and say that was terrible advice, because if everything's led you here and sure, you're basically pretty happy, then it's difficult to go, that was a load of rubbish.
Butterfly effect.
There was a social media brand consultancy agency in 2014 who told me I should get a logo, and they kind of quoted me a package to, like, create a coherent brand across all my social medias and stuff to kind of crystallize myself as like a package deal to be like, hey, this is me as a comedian. This is my viewpoint. This is what I can offer and stuff. And I didn't do it because I couldn't afford what they were asking. And I look back at that and how bad I was as a comedian in 2014. And I always think, thank God for that, because I think I did a lot more like figuring out and trying and failing and getting things wrong since then. And working out what my values were and what I was good at and what I was bad at. And at the time I was kind of just doing the, like, I'm an awkward young guy and I'm a bit bad at dating and isn't life a bit confusing? You know, I was not very different from anybody. I was just like trying things and didn't know what I was. And I think if I had really crystallized myself then and gone, this is who I am as a comedian, it would have been very hard subsequently to grow and to learn and to get things wrong and to try again. So I guess I don't think that was bad advice, because a different comedian probably would have really done well out of it if they'd done more to know what their kind of persona was. But I think it was bad advice for me at the time. And when I look back at it, I go, it was good I didn't take that advice, I think.
That perfectly fits the criteria of bad advice.
Yeah.
And it's a positive that you didn't take the bad advice. What would
I think so.
What do you think your logo would have been? Would it have been like a stencil outline?
I don't know. It did strike me as a really funny thing to fixate on. Of like, what you need is for your name to be written in a really specific way, so that when people look at it, they go, "It's him. It's that guy." And I guess I don't know. I mean, history has proven them right. I think that the people who do approach social media in that way tend to be the ones that get the most out of it. Like, I think they did anticipate this sort of very heavy personal branding thing that came subsequently. So it's not that they were wrong. It's just that I can't be bothered with all of that, you know. I guess it would have been, I'd have tried to make it wacky. I'd have tried to make it a really wacky font. Mm-hmm. That bubble font that had like shiny reflective highlights on it, I'd have done something in that.
I see.
Which would have looked awful, but I'd have at least looked at it and gone, yes, yeah, wacky, it's very me.
And you'd have to sustain that for the past
Yeah, forever. Years. I'd be in my 60s in a real kind of like Johnny Cash hurt era, or like looking back and reflecting on all the things that went wrong, but I'd still be stuck with this shiny bubble logo and going, oh, I can't believe I got tricked into that.
I should have gone for the Metallica font.
Yeah, something a bit more bleak.
Well, that's good. That's good that you didn't go in that direction.
Yeah, I think so. For the best.
What, I was about to do my final question. I realised I didn't say one, which I just a quick question is.
Oh yeah.
On music, you have a love of Muzak and elevator music.
Yeah, find it very funny.
What prompted your love of it? Were you stuck in a lot of lifts?
I bought an album called Lounge Chill Out Background Music Volume 1 in something like 2015. It was $7.99 and it was 30 tracks. And I can't remember what, I think I just wanted one track for a skit that I'd come up with at the time. I wanted some background music. And then it worked out, it was cheaper to buy these 30 tracks really than to buy like two by themselves. So I thought I'll just get it. And then every time I listened to it, just found it fascinating because the whole thing, it's sort of like ambient music. Where the whole idea is like it's music to be ignored and to not pay attention to. It's about creating mood rather than about actually rewarding your attention. And listening to 30 different versions of that, like subtly different. And this one's a bit of a Latin vibe and this one's more kind of aqua, and the different ways in which you can make something that's trying to not be paid attention to, I think, are really funny, like these really like subtle differences. So that ended up being a big set piece in the show I made in 2019, was just going through, I think, something like 10 of those. I think I went through quite a few and tried to work out what the mood of each one was doing and what was a funny way to move to that track. But yeah, it just, I also think it a lot with like the rights free music that you get online, that there are these bands whose job is to make something unidentifiable. Like you want it to just sound like, oh, that's kind of mood music that just disappears into the background. Mm-hmm. And the idea that there are these people out there. Oh, I found out recently, there's these on Disney Plus, there's these short documentaries about Pixar and about people at Pixar, who all the different people who make the films. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy whose job is to compose music for the stand-in versions of the film before they've got the actual score. Because there'll be an actual composer, like a famous composer, that comes in with the final score. But while they're doing test versions with all the storyboards and the unfinished animatics and stuff, there's a guy whose job is to compose something that suggests mood, and then all his work will be removed from the final thing. And he was so zen about it. He was like, yeah, I love it. My job is just to create stuff that helps the film and helps create the mood of the film. And then it's all deleted. Everything I make is deleted and nobody hears any of it. And I love it. It was a real sort of like Buddhist approach.
Yeah.
Felt quite envious of him.
Maybe that is the secret to sort of the both a theatrical performance career and also being incredibly private, is that you perform to no one.
Yeah, you rehearse your shows meticulously and you end up with this very perfect thing that does exactly what you want, and then you never perform it to anybody.
Prince did that. Apparently there's a vault of not only full songs but full music videos, choreographed and edited and backing dances and everything.
But he just never put out.
Yeah, I just thought, I wasn't feeling that, and then it's hidden.
God. There's a film, I think, for some reason I've got Hugo Weaving in my head. I can't remember whether he's in it or whether he produced it or something, but there's a Hugo Weaving film that is locked in a safe that won't open for 100 years or something. That was like the gimmick, was they've made this film and they don't want it to be seen in the lifetime of anybody that was involved in the film. So the safe is going to open in 100 years and then future societies could watch this film that they made. I think it's very funny. Terrible business idea, but very funny way to make art.
It's just a shame it wasn't Matrix 3.
Yeah.
But close enough. It could be. Matrix 5 in there. That's the final.
Yeah.
The final volume. Well, the final question is one that I ask almost all our guests, and just interested to see how people interpret it. Why do we need stories?
Ooh, I think I just read Brian Eno's diary, and he talks a lot in it about what is the purpose for art. He talks about I don't think the artistic community has come up with a good answer to the question, what is art for? And we need to come up with a better idea. And he talks about a lot of different theories in there. And the two that convinced me most, one was less about story and more about art in general. And that's the idea that it's like a chaos lab. It's like a place to get us to become familiar with the parts of ourselves that don't make sense, because you have science that teaches us order and logic and what should happen. And then art that teaches you how to deal with the parts of yourself that aren't covered by that and the parts that feel weird or strange or frightened or whatever. And that's one theory. But I think story specifically falls more in this other theory, which is that it's about empathy and it's about getting people to look at things from somebody else's point of view. In that's the one thing we can do that maybe no other animal can, is that we can imagine things from different perspectives to our own. So story is all about saying, this is what the world looked like from my perspective, or from this person's perspective, or this character. And it's all about learning to build those parts of yourself so that you learn that the world you see is partial, and that actually there are these infinite different possibilities of what the world can look like and feel like and sound like. And every time we hear a story, we remember to build that muscle a little bit, and that muscle that listens to what things are like for other people.
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much for that. That was...
That's all right.
That's very lovely.
Thank Brian Eno, who basically came up with that, and I've cribbed it. But I've put it slightly in my own words.
Well, I know he's a big listener, so it's good you're able to explain that.
Oh, great, good. Yeah.
He writes some letters.
Does he? Always requesting things.
he has us confused for Off Menu, which is a compliment, but I can't help
great
it.
Great podcast. Very good podcast.
It's why it's so hurtful to have to be compared.
To go. Sorry, Brian. That's the other one.
Well, Joz, thank you so much. You can follow Joz on Twitter and Instagram at Joz Norris. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, yeah, I think that's it.
His Radio 4 special, Joz Norris, A Small Talk on Small Talk, is not only brilliant, but streaming now on BBC Sounds, and you can watch his 2016 show, Hello Goodbye, and his 2017 show, The Incredible Joz Norris Locks Himself Inside His Own Show, Then Escapes Against All Odds, 2! On
Stupid
YouTube.
Stupid title, sorry about that.
Brilliant title. Brilliant. It's the longest one, I think, we've had on YouTube and Amazon Prime, respectively, and I heartily encourage you to do all of that. Joz Norris, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.